Welcome, everyone, to the Linus Origin Story podcast. This episode was recorded live in front of a Zoom audience on Monday, March 4th. You can listen to this in audio format across podcast platforms, or you can pop over to YouTube and view it there as well. Host Daria Summers was joined by three amazing women, and I will let her introduce them as we get into the program. Please hang on after the end of this program to hear a bit about our sponsors. We'd like to thank both Tobacco Free, Adagio Health, and UPMC for Life for sponsoring the Veterans Breakfast Club. And if you want to find out more about the VBC, visit our website, www.veteransbreakfastclub.org. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Veterans Breakfast Club Happy Hour for Monday, March 4th. My name is Sean Hall. I'm the Director of Programming with the VBC. And for those of you new to the VBC programming this evening, welcome. So excited to see some new faces out here in the Zoom room. We are a nonprofit and we're based in Pittsburgh, PA. And our mission is to create communities of listening around veterans and their stories to connect, educate, heal, and inspire. We've been doing it since 2008. We continue to do it both here on the Zoom room and in-person breakfasts. So if you ever find yourself in Pittsburgh, you want a good breakfast, come join us for stories and breakfast. With me, as always, is Executive Director Todd DiBastino. Todd, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing very well. And this is our first program for Women's History Month. As many of you know, that I'm a historian. I've taught and wrote history for many years before I did the Veterans Breakfast Club. And we have a remarkable program tonight. But I should let people know that we have one remarkable woman in the Zoom room with us tonight. Julia Parsons, World War II veteran, Navy Wave, a codebreaker. Famous, you know, throughout the country, just turned 103 on Saturday. And I saw that she is in the room with us. She's really a remarkable person.
Thank you, Todd. And tonight's going to go a little bit differently. Usually Todd or I or Glenn are usually handling the hosting duties, but joining us, many of you have heard me talk and just can't talk enough about the Lioness podcast, hosted by Daria Summers. Daria, you're with us tonight. This is kind of almost an extension of the conversations we have had over 11 episodes of the Lioness podcast. How are you doing this evening? Love for you to introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you. I feel like this happy hour is like the culmination of the whole Lioness podcast because just the way it started out, going through the history for the Lioness, for the FETs, the cultural support teams, to the rescinding of the combat exclusion policy, to the 2015 gender integration. And now we're at this point where there's still issues, there's still things to be talked about, things to be resolved, stories to be told. There are many stories to be told. So this is a wonderful way to kind of move beyond the podcast on one level and see everybody's faces and tell this story where things are today, because we have three amazing women guests today. And we're going to we have with us retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Lori Fenner, who is the Director of Government Relations at SWAN, the Service Women Actions Network. And we're going to be talking to her first. And after that, we have a really special discussion with two veterans turned filmmakers who are making a film called The Fight to Fight, which I consider to be, whereas I was one of the filmmakers involved along with Meg McLagan in a film called Lioness about women in 2003 and 2004 who fought in combat in Iraq. What Ellen Herring and Joy Bronson are doing is really making the bookend to that film, because these are about the women who are now that everything, all the different MOSs are open to them. They're proceeding and making use of the gender equity that now is in play across the military services. So I think we're just going to jump in and start with, I'll introduce our first guest, retired Colonel Lori Fenner, who served in the U.S. Air Force for 26 years. There's so much, I can only have time to give a thumbnail. You can fill in the details, Lori. She served in signals and intelligence operations. She taught history at the United States Air Force Academy and strategy at the National War College. She also commanded units at various levels, including as vice wing commander of the 5,000 person worldwide 70th Intelligence Wing. And Lori's been on the staffs of the 9/11 Commission, earned a fellowship at the Supreme Court. And after all of that, after retiring in 2006, she served on the House of Representatives Armed Services Committee, very important, and today works as the Director of Government Relations for SWAN, the Service Women Action Network. So, Lori, welcome. And I didn't want to go into great detail because I want to give you, who can much better articulate your work and your service. And maybe you could just start by telling us, how you came to join the Air Force and take it from there.
Sure. First, let me say I'm really honored to be with this panel, but also all of you today. And I had tears in my eyes with our wave when I saw the picture. So I grew up in a military family. My mom was a combination of a very old school kind of woman, but also new. Forced my sister and I into Civil Air Patrol when we were young because she didn't want us to be part of a single gender scouting program, if that sounds interesting. I didn't go to ROTC because I had to work my way through college, and they had no 4-year scholarships for women in Air Force ROTC. They were Angel Flight Auxiliaries because only men could have 4-year scholarships because only men could be pilots. And that's what the scholarships were for, even if they didn't become pilots. So I ended up graduating, teaching high school, trying to work 2 part-time jobs. Decided if I joined the reserves, I would do better. And that was a natural evolution for me to join the military. I went to see the Marine Corps recruiter and found out in Phoenix they only had heavy equipment operators. Thought that probably wasn't for me. So I went to the Air Force recruiter, and it was kind of my Private Benjamin moment because I thought I could just go to OTS over the summer while I was off teaching and then come back to teach. And then I found out when I got selected for Intel, which was my third choice, but the best choice ever, that I actually had to be gone for a pretty long period of training in that career field. So, 4 years I thought I'd spend, come back to teaching, and that somehow that turned into 20. And then after 9/11, it turned into 26. Dari had asked me how my career evolved, and I would say it was sheer serendipity or luck. I had great mentors and friends. A lot of times for me, I went from ops and intel to academics, which was my vocation, and then back to ops and intel, so I could go between these areas, and my brain was just soaking it all in. So I told myself, always be open to possibilities. Don't close any windows and doors until it becomes impossible to not keep them open, and to always ask for things like, sponsor me for my master's degree so I can go teach at the Air Force Academy, which I wasn't allowed to go to because I was 1979 instead of 1980. And sure enough, everybody said, don't even ask because then you'll be PNG'd out of your career field or whatever. And I learned that you can always ask. So goals matter, but keep adjusting as things evolve. And I got to do the right things, education, PME, the right jobs. My best job ever in the Air Force was as a major because I had the best mentors and I got to do the coolest things in special ops intel that I've ever known of. And then when it was time, I thought I'd get kicked out as a major because I was too aggressive in my personality, or that during that time we were going through a rift, I'd be out. And I got to spend 26 years, so I got to be pretty lucky.
Wow. Well, so what? That sounds like you've had like a lot of positive. You were, let me. How can I put it? I think during the time that you were in service, you can hear different kinds of stories depending on what paths women took and what, and literally where they ended up and who was in front of them, and who happened to be above them or something. But what if when you look at the way the landscape has changed, what What do you see as the key turning points? Because one thing I just one of my and Sean knows this, but one of my things that I'm kind of always like to reference for some reason is the fact that like from 2003 to 2013, when they had the dropping of the combat exclusion policy, so all the women who were serving in the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan or anywhere, but in those conflicts in particular, who found themselves in combat, whether they were a lioness or a CST or a medic or some other MOS, but they were functionally in a gray zone where they were sent off to do things they weren't really supposed to do. But so I mean, that always seems like it built, but I was just for you, so the bulk of your, if you left the Air Force in 2006, I mean, there must have been things that you see that women are doing that you are like, wow, if I could have done it differently.
First thing I should say is, I'm sorry, y'all. I have to leave early because after this, I have to continue to do testimony for the Veterans Affairs Committee on Wednesday. So I just wanted to say that up front because I don't want people to think that I'm rude or that I don't respect our other panelists or something. I love them, but I want to violate our the order here a little bit, Daria, in
Okay.
that it goes back way further. So I might be speaking to some of the older veterans here. Again, I couldn't get an ROTC scholarship. I couldn't go to the Air Force Academy. I was chosen for intel because so many fields were closed. Women couldn't fly or serve on combat ships according to the law. The ground combat exclusion was a policy. So there were many, many career fields closed. I was lucky. A lot of times I was the only woman in the room through my upbringing, and I had my issues with sexual harassment and almost, luckily for me, sexual assault. We dealt with all of those things earlier in time. So whereas I really respect and I work hard on all the current issues, you called on me as a women's historian in Women's History Month, so I can't let you off the hook.
That's great.
I studied 1940 to 1973, and I can tell you what combat isn't anymore. Combat hasn't been for a long time, two rows of tanks or trenches lined up against each other with clear front lines. If it ever was that, it hasn't been for a very long time. So, who's been involved in war and combat? A lot more people than have been recognized through history. And we can talk about women. So my 1940 to 1973 study for today is like Groundhog Day or deja vu all over again day. Here's the story of our and many minorities' histories. When you need us, you want us, and we will come. When you don't think you need us anymore, you send us home. And then all of a sudden, you need us again. We can talk World War II, get out of the service. Oh, wait. Korea, get out of the service. Oh, we need especially medical people in Vietnam. We might even draft women. Okay. And then Reagan comes in. That's when I came in. All of, well, not all, but many, many. I worked with a lot of NCOs. And by the way, signals intelligence was heavily women because we had a lot of linguists. Unfortunately, they couldn't fly on the RC-135s until much later. Reagan comes into office, and a lot of the guys I worked with thought, thank God, because he's against women in the military, we bet, and he's going to let all the women attrit. He sounded like Charles LeMay, okay? And luckily for us, he wasn't like that at all. But I would remind you that right after World War II, when they were deciding to regularize women in the forces, we had a 2% limit. That wasn't a quota. That was a ceiling on our end strength for women. We could only have one colonel per service, and it was the leader of that service. And if that woman stayed in past her time as the leader, she had to revert to lieutenant colonel status. For men, that would have been unheard of. So we came out of that when Johnson, President Johnson, lifted it. 1973, the all-volunteer force, when they talk about recruiting difficulties today, and heaven forbid anybody says it's because of the woke military in front of me, because women and minorities have carried the military since the all-volunteer force started, and we still are. So you see where I get passionate and kind of militant about all this. So I came in 1980, like I say, Reagan Revolution. So that's my short history of women in the military. I recommend to you all a current book, Forgotten Warriors, by an Australian author, Percy. She has a very wide range. But when I have to look things up, I go back to Jean Holm. You didn't know I had biz aids, did you? I go back to Jean Holm, Women in the Military, the updated revision in 1992, that maybe some of your people here on the podcast are contributed to, helped her write. My own, if I could stump, it's not in print, so I'm not selling it. Women in Combat. Either you need these women or you don't, from Margaret Chase Smith in the 1950s. We use that in his gender issues about citizenship and service. And Aaron Solaro's Women in the Line of Fire. These books are from the 1990s, the early 2000s. They all have women serving under combat conditions and not being recognized for it. So even the lioness have foremothers. And Daria, you probably were referring to the Persian Gulf War. Not only are we trying to get the 310 women from JAX recognized, right, all the women from 2003 to 2010 who precede, of course, you know, JAX, yeah, and then the women from 1990 on, Lori Pietzwa, Maria Rossi, Rhonda Cornum, all of those that we can name who were killed, taken POW, or severely disabled. So now if you want to talk about me, we can talk about from 1980 on, but you've heard a lot already.
Well, I think that's brilliant. And I think, yes, I mean, you caught me, because my concentration certainly has been, you know, since my sort of attention got focused on it, in the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts 2003 on. But you're absolutely right in showing how, like, you know, even depending on where we come into the story, and certainly I'm not a veteran. I'm not someone who's ever served. I come on it from the outside looking at the story, but and I enter at a certain point, but there's so much history beyond it that, you know, it's great that you make that point. I mean, probably a lot more people get that. But I was just wondering if you could, maybe if we could segue, because I know you have time constraints, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing with SWAN, and are some of the key legislation that are going on right now that are important to women.
Absolutely. So Service Women's Action Network has been around since 2008. Ellen Haring is one of my forebearers. Thank you, Ellen. And we've worked on military sexual trauma and military sexual assault and harassment since 2008. We have about 10,000 members. So anybody can sign up. It doesn't even cost you a fee. And we welcome men as well. We welcome all people. So our primary thing is to eliminate sexual assault in the military. But we also find that it's rampant at the VA. So we work for both active duty women, reservists, guard. We're even working with the Coast Guard and for the Coast Guard, and certainly for veterans. We worked, and Ellen was a big part of this, to open all occupations to qualified women, and that counted with the combat exclusion. So we had one of the legal cases as well that was just resolved this last spring, Swan v. Austin, for over 10 years that people worked on. We're still working on the Army National Guard and integrating Marine basic training. We also care about women's health care and a lot of stuff that's in the news, the interim federal rule at the VA, IVF eligibility expansion, maternal issues, birth control copays, contraceptive copays. We work with DOD and VA on policy, military justice reform, and again, health issues. We work with coalitions like the Military Coalition, the DOD-VA Coalition, which works on reproductive rights, the Military Reform Coalition, which works on military justice. The Women's Veterans Working Group, that is has a lot of the bigger organizations, DAV, VFW, and so on, and other individual partners. We work with the IVF Working Group as well. So we also join as amicus with, we don't have our own, any more of our own cases right now, but we join on amicus briefings for GI Bill and larger veterans issues. In fact, we're interested in them all: homelessness, food insecurity, very, very many mental health issues, very many issues. In Congress right now, and I'm talking on Wednesday, so recent memory, but I'm sure I'll forget something. The SAVES Act also speaks to making MST claims easier at the VA, going from the military and transition to the VA, includes digital harassment now as well, and would lower the evidentiary limits so that you could have lay testimony after the fact. The Mammo Act, simple as providing better mammogram access and equipment and such to especially veterans. The Deborah Sampson Act, as I said, IVF eligibility expansion, copays for contraception, get rid of them. We watch appropriations carefully that there's not poison pills in the bill like anti-DEI stuff. There's a new bill that's just being laid on the table to provide for menopause research, as both our military women stay in longer and we have aging women veterans. The menopause issues are writ large. And recently, the Protecting Moms Who Serve Act. And we absolutely support the JAX Act, but we're trying to make it JAX Plus to recognize all of the LIONESS, the female engagement teams. And we were successful in the House in getting a Ramirez Amendment that would call for research back to 1990 to the Persian Gulf War. And as if I'm living still, I want to go back even further to all living women veterans who have suffered under combat conditions. When somebody asked me, well, how do you define combat? As I said earlier, I know not how not to define it.
Wow.
Our big thing is culture change. Culture change in the military and at the VA. Everything else flows from that. And it's hard, but we have been successful at building aircraft carriers, going to the moon, stopping people from smoking in their government offices. We can change attitudes and behaviors when we want to.
Well, I mean, that's like a tremendous list. And that's, I mean, you have, that's not just you. You have all of SWAN working on those things, right?
Thank you for saying that, because there's eight of us. I'm part-time and it's only me here in DC. But I have a research assistant who is an intern this summer with me here. She's back at school in Wisconsin. And our case manager, who takes calls 24/7 on our helpline, she's not a veteran, but has really gotten involved with veterans and military women who call our helpline. And she is ready to learn everything I can throw at her. And the two of them help me proofread my testimony, are good people to bounce things off. We have 9 very great board members, most of whom are veterans, both male and female. So, but the sum total of the SWAN staff is 8 people, half of which are part-time.
Wow. And so I know that you have a hard out, but I just want to, I'm just like floored, probably like a lot of other people, floored by the list of things. And I'm glad you have 8 people, but I feel like you should have more. But it, just because of, you know, the work that the Veterans Breakfast Club has put into the podcast on the Lioness, the origin stories, and that arc, which is just, I mean, that's, and while I know there are many other examples, and we don't have enough time to go into them right now, even in this segment of women doing things, but the Lioness arc is that's a clear narrative arc. Well, one of the things that fascinates me is that when I was last in touch with you, it was, seems like there's this catch 22 that in order for members in the House from both parties to get really behind it, they want numbers. They want hard numbers about how many record keeping. And yet the fact that it was, at least with the Lioness and maybe half a little bit with the FETs, but definitely with the Lioness, it was kind of an off the books program. You don't have hard numbers. And I'm just wondering, how do you see that getting resolved?
The two things. Congress could just, well, there's the real way Congress works. So some people have talked to me already. The Senate needs to pass a JAKS Plus Act, both the JAKS Act plus my pet thing here, the JAKS Plus Act, and then they would have to resolve the House version. The Senate doesn't need a Congressional Budget Office score. It's the CBO score that people are using in some cases for an excuse not to include the Lioness or the FETs. It is a catch-22 because commanders in the field recognize the need for these women, both as an extra pair of hands to shoot guns, as well as to talk to Muslim women in the villages and stuff and collect intel. When the male commanders on the ground realized that this was a real military necessity, we're not talking about, women's rights or they thought they were doing people a favor or anything. When they realized that, they violated the combat exclusion policy the way it was being interpreted. All law comes down to interpretation, and that's why, for those of you who are lawyers, that's why we employ so many lawyers. So the House won't take on more numbers if you can't tell me the numbers. And we can't tell the numbers because the JAKS Act only recognizes two MOSs, what the Air Force would call AFSCs, two, and only recognizes 2010 to 2021. So they do pick up some of the women that were qualified before the combat exclusion was lifted, and they did all kinds of gymnastics. We'll attach the women to the unit instead of assigning them to the unit.
Right.
And I won't talk too long because I know Ellen knows this story way better than I do. But what was happening was military necessity made it obvious. Now, how do we get the numbers? First of all, we need the Congress to know these women earned it. Even the VA person told me, we don't know the numbers. We're going to have to do lots of research. DOD will have to do it, blah, blah, blah. VA gets money to take care of veterans. Take care of the veterans. The women already earned it. Okay, so even Daryl Issa, who is sponsoring the bill in the House, said it shouldn't rely on an accounting number. Okay, now how do we figure it out? We also teach the VA people who are deciding on these claims that if women were in a certain place at a certain time, just like the presumptions for the PACT Act now, which Swan worked on, the Talk Exposure Act, the presumption that if you were with certain units in certain places at certain times, you should have a presumption that your TBI, your PTSD, other disabilities might have been caused by ill-fitting PPE, if nothing else. So the other thing would be some university researchers or others who have a lot of money and a lot of people could, the VA could do outreach as well. Somebody could do major outreach and try to get as many women to come forward as possible so that some researcher could come up with a specific number. The easiest, fastest thing now is for the Senate to pass a JAKS Plus and then make it conform with the House. And Swan has been on a mission to make sure that all the House members who voted to approve JAKS in its current form, which we do not oppose,
right,
but all of those who voted for it and passed it in the HVAC, for them to be willing to come back to the House floor and take those amendments and approve everybody.
Wow.
And I know I talk. You can tell I'm a history professor, Todd, and of those others who are.
Well, I think that, no, but I thank you for that because, and I'm sure, I know you have to go, but maybe Ellen can answer questions if some of the details or I can help a little. But I it's very good to get that sort of concise explanation of where things stand, because then, to the extent that, we can put out the word to get people to help, people know people can call in and say, I served as a lioness or this. I mean, I get those emails and texts all the time of people who are, see something or heard the podcast, who want to, say, I did that too. And I was like the third iteration of it in Ramadi or something. So, I mean, it's important just to get the word out. I mean, networks help. So, thank you very much, Lori. I really, really appreciate it. I want to be very respectful of your time.
Well,
But
let me add one thing, and I see Sean actually has his hand up, but let me add one
okay.
thing, and that is the congressman on the HVAC also made it sound like the sky was falling, that if they opened it up to Lioness and FET, which is also ironic because the Congress didn't let women serve in what we called combat, that there would be thousands and thousands and thousands, and it would be so expensive. Well, the number is larger than 310, but it's not thousands and thousands of thousands. If you think of the percentage of women in the military total, and then the percentage of women in the war zone, and then the percentage of women who went outside the wire in these steads, then we're not talking that many people, besides the fact that they already earned it.
Right.
And then you have to count a smaller number that need those VA benefits or recognition and haven't gotten it yet, because some of them are. We have two new SWAN staff members who both served in FETs and CSTs, and I want to connect them with you, Daria. So Sean
Cool.
doesn't have his hand up anymore, so I wonder if he wanted to talk or what.
No, Lori, thank you for all of this. There was a great question by Renee here in the chat, just how can we support SWAN? And I put the link to your website in the chat here. I'm sure that it's go to the website, learn, donate, vote. It seems like from your site.
Yes, and anybody who wants to volunteer, we've been working on reactivating a speakers bureau, doing some take actions and helping with that. But telling your stories to the wider world is sometimes scary, but is important. And if some people come around and ask you to record your name and your place of service and what you were doing and everything, please contribute to the research that could really help in this stead. And support the congressmen and representatives who support women in the military and women veterans. That's what I would say. And we're bipartisan and nonpartisan whenever we can be. And I see that other people are writing in the chat. So I'll follow up with Sean and Todd and Daria and our two other panelists, Ellen and Joy. And you're welcome to contact me at SWAN as well, governmentrelations@servicewomen.org. Thank you
Thank you,
so much
Lori.
for having me on. I want to stay, but I'm stressing about Wednesday. If you tune into the HVAC, SVAC hearing on Wednesday, a whole bunch of veterans organizations are testifying on Wednesday, DAV on Thursday. They have a fantastic new report out on women's health. Unfortunately, the suicide numbers are horrendous among women veterans and getting worse. And then on the 13th, there will be another whole group of veterans organizations. SWAN is the only one with women in its name. And if you wait until after those dates, they'll be on the websites and you can fast forward through anything you don't want to hear.
Gosh, Lori, thank you so much. We're all gonna, fortunately, people who want to who have put questions in, Sean and I are gonna make sure that you get them or they get answered somehow. So, but I know you have so much work and you're one person down in DC doing all this. And even though I've communicated with you so much on email, this is the first time I've met you face to face via Zoom. And thank you so much for giving us this amount of time. I really appreciate it. I know it's a big week for you.
Great. I know I look older than the photograph that you had or what's on the website.
No,
So
no. Everyone
That's
looks
par for the
fantastic.
course. That's par for the course on the hill, is everybody has, you can't recognize people because their pictures are so young looking. I see people asking, have I ever heard that people said women didn't serve in Vietnam? Absolutely. Or they think that there were only MASH nurses that looked like Houlihan in Vietnam, and that's not true either. In fact, unfortunately, a couple of my veteran friends have passed away who served in other steads, intel, admin, and so on in Vietnam. And yes, they got shot at too.
That's
Thank you,
another
guys.
thing I can talk to you about. All right, bye, Lori. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori. Daria,
Bye.
wow, it sure seems like we have our work cut out for us with the Lioness podcast. If we could gather all of those stories, elicit change, right?
Yeah, I mean, wow. Okay. Just anyway, it was I'm really thankful that we got Lori for the time that we did. But now we get for the rest of the program, I'm really excited because we have two really favorite people I've been talking to and getting to know. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Dr. Ellen Herring, who is a West Point graduate. She holds a PhD in conflict analysis and resolution and has taught at the Army Command and General Staff College and Georgetown University. And as a senior fellow at Women in International Security, she led and directed the Combat Integration Initiative, which provided research and recommendations on the 2015 integration of women into the ground combat forces. She's done a whole lot of other things too, which I'll let her talk about. But and she is now what I like to call a veteran turned filmmaker, along with former U.S. Navy pilot and filmmaker Joy Bronson. She was a Navy pilot who flew, and I just found this out today. CH-46, are those Chinook?
Chinook.
Chinook,
Yeah,
sorry.
but they're not
Okay.
Chinook. They're Boeing VERTOL, but they
Okay.
look like that.
All right. I tried to pretend
They're
like I knew
big and
something.
ugly.
Okay. Anyway, I'm just going to say CH-46 helicopters at sea before and during the Gulf War. And she later served as a fixed wing primary flight instructor. After leaving the military, she spent several years at Discovery's Wings and Science Channels working on programs. But her focus as a filmmaker has always been on the telling of the story of women's changing role in the military, and her collaboration with Ellen Herring on the upcoming feature documentary, The Fight to Fight, is a culmination of her passion. And I just want to say that I may have mentioned this earlier, but their film upcoming, it's in process, but The Fight to Fight, I really see as it's probably more than that, but I also see it as a bookend or some kind of follow-up from Lioness. And I couldn't be happier that it's being made by two veterans because it's a story only they could tell. So I want to introduce you both and just ask if it's possible for each of you to talk a little bit about yourselves and how you joined and how you sort of got to this point where you're now making this film. Joy, would you like to start?
Sure. So, thank you so much, Daria, and thank you for being so welcoming to me and to Ellen and connecting us with people in the film industry and trying to help us see this thing get made. So I'll just tell you, I was wonderful to hear Lori and everything she had to say, and it's great to be flanked by historians because I am not that. I'm just someone who wanted to go fly. And I had a friend who was in the Air Force that was going through flight school. And I went and visited one weekend. And in the officers club, there was a woman in a flight suit. And, all the other women there were talking diapers and babies because they were spouses, and all the guys were talking with their hands. And I went and talked to her. And she said, hey, I said, I didn't know women could do that. And at the time, I was in graduate school, and I'm like, that's interesting. I'll keep that in my back pocket. Women can do this. And she told me how restricted it was, and it was, right? It was the 1980s. So I'll give you a little bit of background on women in military aviation. But in any case, I was working on a master's degree in geological sciences when I finished. The price of oil dropped to less than $9 a barrel,
and I did not want to sit indoors and work at a desk. And there was no exploration happening. So I thought, well, I could join the Air Force. And I went down to the Air Force recruiter and they said, I'm so sorry, you have to be 5'4". And I'm not that tall. So I went down to the Navy recruiter who said, oh yeah, we'll take you, you know, outside the norm, but aeronautically adaptable. And so I went through aviation officer candidate school and I started out and it was me and 90 guys. And we finished as a class of 30. And I think I was number 3 in the class. So, you know, we lost 2/3 of the guys along the way. And I went off to flight school. And at that time, so that was 1986, and women had been flying for about 12 years. So in 1972, Admiral Zumwalt, who was then head of the Navy, was trying to deal with, as Lori was talking about, the all-volunteer service, right? So during the Vietnam War, people were preferentially enlisting in the Navy to avoid being drafted into the Marine Corps and the Army. They couldn't count on that anymore. They had poor retention and poor morale. And he was doing a lot of things to try to you know, change the culture and make it better. And one of the things he did was he allowed women to go to flight school. And they started out with 6 women. And I'm going to pitch 2 books here because I don't know the Air Force version of the story. But there's a recent, very good book called Wings of Gold that talks about the women who integrated military aviation in the Navy, and another one called Fly Girls Revolt in that talks about women in the Air Force. But anyway, I went off to flight school and I understood there were restrictions. And, you know, one of the main restrictions, of course, was by law, you couldn't be assigned to combat aircraft. And, you know, I went through and did well in flight school and I had my choice of what I wanted to fly. And I chose to fly helicopters because it was one place where you could deploy. You could go do what the guys were doing, right? So everything else was, you were going to fly, you know, if you were going to fly jets, you were going to be electronic warfare, or you were going to be, you know, flying admirals around in a Learjet. It wasn't very operational. So I chose the most operational thing I could do. And get through flight school, check into my first fleet squadron. And I check in on the same day as a buddy of mine from flight school, Dave. And we get to the squadron and Dave goes off to sea, does his co-pilot tour, comes back. He comes back. Several months later, I'm sitting in the squadron doing my, I was the maintenance training and improvement officer, doing my desk drop. And then suddenly Dave's going back to sea again as the aircraft commander. And that got my attention. I'm like, I am going to sit here forever, because it was essentially up to the commanding officer of the ship whether or not they were going to take a woman on. And it was the old beds and bathrooms story, right? We don't have any place to berth her. We can't give up a stateroom, blah, blah, blah. So I found a policy that said, if you have a pilot in your squadron as the commanding officer who doesn't make aircraft commander in a year, you need to explain to the air wing commander why. And I walked into the CO's office and, you know, asked, you know, permission to talk to him about this. And he realized, oh, you know, I got to do something about this because I'm going to be in trouble if she doesn't go to sea. So he starts making some phone calls and one guy is willing to take me on. And he happened to be a guy who was he had been the ex-commanding officer of the Blue Angels. And he was doing his deep draft qual to learn to drive ship so he could be commander of an aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. So the important thing was he had a daughter who was going through college and was going to come to the aviation pipeline. And he said, yeah, bring her on. And he gave me his at-sea cabin. And so I went to sea and it was me. It was, and funnily enough, and Lori would get the joke because Carl Vinson was, when they took away the restriction on women, you know, the original restrictions on women. And I want to say it was 60-15 anyway. Carl Vinson was one who just said, make sure that women can't go to sea, right? keep them off of combat aircraft and combat ships. But I deployed with the Carl Vinson Battle Group because the aircraft carrier was named for him. And it was me and 7,500 of my best guy friends at sea for 6 months. So, you know, it was a very all male environment. And that, you know, that was my experience. When I got back, we immediately turned around, did the Gulf War. And I was on an ammunition ship. So not a combat ship, but a really, really good target, right? So what would happen is the aircraft carriers would come down to the south end of the Gulf every night, and we would do vertical replenishment. So we would do external lifts and reload the carrier with bombs. And then they'd go back north and do their sorties, and they'd come back to us at night in the south, and we would replenish them again. So did that all high op tempo all through the Gulf War. And when we got back, that's when, you know, America realized women were there. There was no front line. Women were everywhere. The services were going to have to figure out what to do. Things were in the works to try to bring down the combat exclusion for women in aviation. And there was one woman, one of those first six, one of the pioneers, Rosemary Mariner, who was really leading that effort. And she started something called Women in Military Aviation, which I never heard of because even though I was doing it, there were only a couple hundred of us and there was no internet. And, you know, but the people who were more closely connected with her, they all went and took leave, and they went and you're not allowed to lobby when you're in uniform, but they went and they educated people in Congress about the situation and asked for you know, the law to change. And so finally, you know, that was working its way through. And then the big thing that happened that I pushed it along is, you know, was the shameful scandal of Tailhook in 1991. And, you know, the embarrassment that the military suffered, that the Navy suffered during Tailhook really pushed things forward. And at that point, Les Aspin in April of 93, you know, changed the rules so that women could fly in combat cockpits. And it took, you know, a couple of years to get people through training. I was a flight instructor at the time that the first women, they were my students who were then going to go integrate, you know, the operational jet bases. And anyway, that's kind of my story. And I got to know Ellen because I wanted to talk about the culture. And I wanted to do a film. I ended up working for the Discovery Channel, and I eventually did some social justice films with some people. And I wanted to talk about women work and gender equity in America. And on Memorial Day weekend of 2012, I picked up the New York Times, and there was an article about two women, Ellen Herring and Jane Baldwin, and they were suing the Secretary of Defense to remove the ground combat exclusion policy. So that was the last barrier by policy or law that said the US government could say, you cannot do this job because you are not a male. Because you're female, you are excluded. And so I called up the phone, and that's when I met Ellen.
Thanks, Joy. Amazing. Can I just point out before we transition to Ellen, because what Joy, what you just said is that it reminds me, because Ellen is on episode 10 of the Lioness podcast, where we talked to Ellen and Professor Ann Coughlin down at the University of Virginia Law School, because she had started the Molly Pitcher Project, which was the origin of the initial phase of that lawsuit. And Ellen, I remember on that, you told me that you got involved in it because someone showed you an article about someone, you know, doing the Molly Pitcher Project to try to see if they could get DOD to, so it's just good for the press.
Yeah, that's right, Daria. It was that article that kind of spurred my, caused me to contact Ann Coughlin. I was really thought at that time, I was in 06. And so I was really, it was beyond the point where any changes would affect my career. But I felt like it was time for people to step up, for women in the military to step up and do what essentially women aviators had done years before. In 1992, women aviators had actually caused the removal of the only law remaining on the books that limited women's military service. So 1992, women aviators get that law struck down. 1993, Les Aspin orders all services to open combat aviation to women. He directs the Navy to draft legislation to repeal the combat ship exclusion, and he orders the Army and the Marine Corps to study opening more assignments to women. By this time, and then 1994 rolls around, and the ground combat exclusion policy is established by DOD. By this time, I've been in the Army 10 years. I graduated from West Point in 1984. I'd been commissioned as a signal officer, which was one of the few occupations open. Actually, there were quite a few occupations open to women, but the majority of positions were going to the infantry armor, and we were excluded from all of those. And what I didn't know at the time when I commissioned in 1984 was that most of the general senior leaders, general officers in the Army at least, but actually across the services, were drawn from those select combat occupations that women could not access. So in the Army, it was 80% of our senior leaders, and by senior leaders, I mean GOs, were being pulled from the occupations that I and my women colleagues could not access. So the likelihood of any of us ever becoming military senior leaders was slim to none, even though we could have relatively successful careers as support officers. And I did. In the Signal Corps, I had a pretty good career. Promoted right along with my male colleagues, interesting assignments, and I had no complaints about my career until I got to more senior positions when things began to be position assignments. Like I could be the deputy in organizations, but I couldn't be the three because I didn't have a combat background. So this was very senior. I was a lieutenant colonel assigned to Joint Task Force, and I couldn't do operations, but I could be the XO. It was crazy because they were coded for combat positions. Anyways, 1994 establishes the direct ground combat exclusion rule, which specifically states that women shall be excluded from units below the brigade level whose primary mission is to engage in direct ground combat. However, 7 years later, as we all know, in 2001 and then 2003, the invasions in Afghanistan and Iraq really put that policy to a test, because it's nearly impossible in those types of wars, but as you pointed out, even in previous wars, to keep women out of harm's way. And in fact, it also challenged male leaders by this time, because they're commanding units that in some cases may be 10 to 20% women, and they're limited in what they can allow women to do in terms of assignment to the combat units that they are supporting. So specifically, I'm going to give you some examples. In innumerable instances, support units are engaging in direct ground combat. This includes MP units who are tasked with providing convoy clearances, engineer units tasked to clear convoy routes, and even quartermaster and transportation units that come under direct fire. For example, in 2005, MP Sergeant Leanne Hester is awarded the Silver Star for an engagement that occurred when her platoon was providing convoy security. Then even support units, commanders who are tasked with supporting ground combat units find their hands tied when they can't assign women down to those units that they're supporting. And in many instances, support commanders just simply ignored the policy. For example, medic Monica Lynn Brown is awarded the Silver Star after she is attached. And this was the way they were getting around the assignment policy. They were attaching women to ground combat units. So Monica Lynn Brown is attached to a combat unit as their medic. And in fact, the unit comes into some serious action, and she is awarded the Silver Star for valor on the field really saving the lives of a number of combat arms guys on the ground in Afghanistan. And so this, we're gonna attach them, we're not gonna assign them because this is men, male commanders figure out ways to work around how to use the women in their units because they can't violate this assignment policy rule. So then we've got things that these kind of pioneering programs begin to develop that are also workarounds. So the Army in 2004, Army pioneers the Lioness program, which is a program that attaches women to ground combat units to search women in the field. After the Lioness is pioneered, the Army develops a female engagement team program, again, to engage with women on the ground and to support combat units that are engaged in combat. Special Operations Community comes on board quite a bit later at 2010, and they create the what they call the cultural support teams, which embeds women in both ODA teams and then with the Army Rangers and direct action. I did my dissertation research on the active research, the work that those women had done with the special operations communities. They engaged repeatedly in combat operations throughout the time that they were assigned to these ODAs and then the Ranger teams. Then in that's 2010, 2012, this lawsuit, I hear about this lawsuit at the University of Virginia. Ann Coughlin, I contact her, and I think I have this crazy idea that this is going to be like a class action lawsuit, and I'm going to support a class action lawsuit with advice. I know how to do some research. I can provide a lot of what I think is a lot of support, but it ended up being the lawsuit was just two plaintiffs, myself and Command Sergeant Major Jane Baldwin, because many of the other women that they were considering, they just didn't think that they, a lot of them had PTSD, frankly. A lot of them had been in combat themselves, and they were worried about how they would handle if they had to take the stand against the Secretary of Defense. And so myself and Command Sergeant Major Jane Baldwin, we were quite a bit senior, and we were, vetted by this team of lawyers, and they said, okay, we're going to go forward with you too. So we became those two initial plaintiffs. 6 months after we filed our lawsuit in May of 2012, the ACLU comes on board with a second lawsuit. That lawsuit had four more women, service women, two of whom had Purple Hearts, two had been awarded Valor. One had the Distinguished Flying Cross, and they had a lot more. And it was great to see it because now we had two lawsuits, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, all challenging this policy that was only a policy, not a law. And we had so many examples of women successfully performing in combat that it was just going to be, I can't even imagine what the lawyers on the Secretary of Defense side were talking about, how they were going to defend this policy. And in fact, they never did defend it. Secretary Panetta in January of 2013, he struck the policy down. He said, policy is gone. And they made this, what to us was a historic announcement, that the policy would be gone and that women would be allowed to integrate ground combat units as infantry, armor, and special operations if they could meet the test. But he gave the services 3 years to study how they would fully integrate their services. And he also said, and he would consider exceptions to the policy if that service could explain clearly why women could not integrate those units. The only service that came on board requesting a service or an exception was the Marine Corps. And the Marine Corps' exception to policy was based on some very flimsy research that they had done that just didn't hold up to scrutiny. And the Secretary of Defense at this time now, it's Ash Carter, he says, no Marine Corps, you haven't provided a justification that should exempt all women from combat in the Marine Corps. So that was 2013. Well, that was the end of 2015. And in 2016, all positions open across the services to women. It was in 2016 that the first women began to integrate infantry and armor in the Army. And by now I'm retired. I'm a professor and researcher. I've got some backing. I was at Georgetown University. And I said, we should research this. We should look at the women, these first women, and we should follow them for 5 years and figure out what their experiences is, how, what do they need, what has been done to integrate them. And so that kind of begins my research effort, which is what the documentary is based on. So the purpose of our research project, and our intent was to interview women for 5 years who were integrating the infantry armor units of the Army. We traveled to Fort Benning, which is now Fort Moore, Georgia. When they were in their initial training, they were all in their basic officer leader course. I had a connection to one of the women who was an armor officer, and you're going to see a little clip with this woman. Her name is Charlie Folletta. She had recently graduated from Harvard University. She was there to be an arm training to be an armor officer. And I reached out to Charlie and I said, hey, we're thinking about doing this research. What do you think? She said, absolutely. And she gathered, actually, she invited her female classmates to a breakfast with us. I went down there with one of my camera operators, was my sister. And we had literally checked out cameras from Georgetown and George Mason University's connections to both schools. We were a team of four with not much camera experience. But anyways, we went down to Fort Benning. They came to our initial breakfast. They heard about the research that we were interested in doing, and 36 of them. We were shocked at how many women showed up. We were only able to interview 22 women over that weekend. But those 22 women, we followed then for 5 years, doing annual interviews with them. We had funding problems. We had deployment problems. We had them, once they got to know us and we knew them, then they started asking us for assistance with problems that they were having. They asked us to host workshops, because what we quickly realized, we were only following women officers, and enlisted women were having a much harder time. The women officers were having a rough time, but the enlisted women were having an even harder time integrating these units, and they followed the women officers. So as each year went by, enlisted women are joining these units. They didn't join that first summer because the Army had a policy to establish a leaders first program whereby women officers would integrate. And then once women officers were in the units, enlisted women could join those units. Anyways, we were many challenges over those 5 years. I will tell you that at the end of the 5 years, we have this repository of, it's a video archive of the first 5 years of integration for this first class of women. 22 women we interviewed. 11 by today, and I'm going to give you some data for today. Of those 22 women, 11 have resigned their commissions. 5 have rebranched to non-combat branches. Only 6 remain on active duty as infantry and armor officers. 3 are in the infantry and 3 are armor officers. Some of the findings, additional findings that we made in the course of 5 years, of the original 22, 2 reported that they were sexually assaulted. In both cases, those who reported their sexual assaults, they were dealt with. One was assaulted on deployment by the unit chaplain, who was convicted of sexual assault. And I don't know whether he's still there at Leavenworth, but he was sent to Leavenworth to serve a sentence. Another one was a commander that assaulted one of the women. He was punished in a way. He was an 05 at the time, battalion commander. She was a soldier, a woman officer in his unit. He was not promoted beyond 05, and he had been on a promotion selection list to 06, and he was forced to retire as an 05. To me, that's not a big punishment, but anyways, it was what happened in that case. Of our initial 22, 7 sustained injuries severe enough to require surgeries or medical attentions, including broken bones, torn ligaments, a puncture wound. And in one case, one of our armor officers, she actually lost vision in her left eye after an armor training accident when they were deployed to Poland. One of the tracks, she was checking the tracks before they went out to the field, and they had installed one of the tracks improperly. As she checked it, it flew off and hit her in the left eye. Luckily, she had eye pro on. And so she still has her eye, but she can't see out of it anymore. And she's still on active duty. So about 2 years ago, well, we had finished up our interviews in 2021. We needed to get them archived. And so they were very rough, the interviews we did, because we aren't professionals. So we needed the videos edited and we needed them transcribed. And Joy and I reconnected a couple of years ago, and she really helped me get through the editing and archiving of these interviews. And she's using that content as kind of source material for the broader movie. And I'm going to pass it on to Joy to talk about the documentary.
May I jump in? I'm sorry to interrupt. Before we get to that, we want to take a quick station break, remind everyone here that we are the Veterans Breakfast Club. Our mission is creating communities of listening around veterans and their stories to connect, educate, heal, and inspire. I want to share my screen here real quick, as we have a couple sponsors that we want to thank for providing support for the VBC and this evening's program. But first, I want to say that we thank all of you our audience for joining us here and for helping us to create this community of listening since 2008. The programs we share connect, heal, educate, and inspire, and they are only made possible by your generous support. You can donate to the Veterans Breakfast Club by visiting our website, veteransbreakfastclub.org. And as you can see on the screen, we would like to thank one of our sponsors, Tobacco Free, Adagio Health. They provide, they are dedicated to preventing and reducing tobacco use, educating people about tobacco hazards, and advocating for healthier places to live, work, and play. You can find out more information about them at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org. And we would also like to thank UPMC for Life. They can help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans that can save you money and get you more benefits. You can view all their plan options by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. And this is our upcoming one of our free quarterly magazines. First one for 2024. If you don't receive this in the mail, it's because we don't have your address. Please send your address over to Todd or I, Todd@veteransbreakfastclub.org, or Sean, Sean@veteransbreakfastclub.org. And we'd be happy to put you on our mailing list so that you can receive one of our free quarterly magazines. And at the end of the program, we will also have a survey in the chat. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know how you liked or disliked this program. We always are welcome to critiques because we read these very closely. I, for one, am loving this program. And also, if you stick on Zoom afterwards, we will have a clip of the documentary that we will be hearing about just shortly. That clip will be for Zoom only after we end the live stream. So stick with us on Zoom if you would like to see a clip of the fight to fight. Also, a final scuttlebutt. We have two more dogs for our brave. I interviewed this wonderful gentleman here. I'll put a link into the chat for anyone interested in listening. Dogs for Our Brave is a great nonprofit organization that is providing dogs for veterans in need. Thank you, Daria. Didn't mean to interrupt, but on with the show.
Okay, and Ellen, that was a fantastic rundown. And I just want to let you know, like, as a documentary filmmaker, I'm just like, that's what it's like. If documentary filmmaking has its own kind of trenches, and now you've been in them. But I also want to just, for me, because like my takeaway for, and you know, maybe this is more obvious to some and not to others, but it's just the idea that you can do things like the government can or rescind the combat exclusion policy. You can open everything up, but those are just, whether they're laws or orders or policies or regulations, but there's a whole other sort of curve, learning curve that has to happen to have them implemented. And I think what everything that your film is aiming for and doing, and the material you've collected, is really exposing that and saying, wow, it's not that simple, because of course this has been, you know, sort of like a male warrior culture, just because that's, you know, how it started out for so long. Those things are hard to change. So I feel like you gave a really good sort of explanation of that and how we got to that point. But that's something, because if we don't focus on how is that change happening, it might not happen. But now, Joy, tell us about the film.
So
or how are you working with Ellen's materials, which sound like just amazing foresight to think at that moment you had to move in and capture them, because, you know, that's where the magic is.
So Ellen's, I'm going to roll back just to 2012. So when I read that article, this ACLU hadn't filed their lawsuit yet. It was just Ellen and Jane Baldwin versus SecDef, right, versus Panetta. And I grabbed a friend of mine that I'd work with at the Discovery Channel. He's an aviation photographer, and he was a good friend of mine. And we did a road trip, and we went down and we interviewed Ellen. We interviewed Kayla Williams, who wrote Love My Rifle More Than You. We interviewed Jeanette Haney, who was a Marine Corps Cobra pilot in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tally Parham, who was one of the first F-18 pilots in the Air National Guard, and started, you know, when you guys are saying the Veterans Breakfast Club, every veteran has a story. And when you meet these women and you hear their stories, and I mean, they're all really smart and really interesting and have a great sense of humor, right? Because they had to roll with the punches, and there were plenty of punches, but they're like kind of irresistible, right? When you start to hear who they are. And so I went and did these interviews wanting to make this film back in 2012. And then suddenly 2013, right? SecDef doesn't want to go to court and defend himself against these lawsuits against all of these decorated women that joined Ellen and Jane in the ACLU lawsuit. And so then Ellen had she was doing a conference, a panel about, she called it the Combat Integration Initiative. And they had invited in all of these amazing women who had been decorated, who told their stories. And so we did stand-ups with women there who were either part of the lawsuit or were, you know, had been injured and decorated in Iraq and Afghanistan, and did some stand-ups there. So we're all, it's like celebratory. Everything's fabulous. The policy's going away. And then there's going to be a 3-year study. Okay. So I think if you talk to Lori or Ellen or any historian of what happens when people want to slow walk something, is there's a study. And, you know, the Marine Corps in particular, and the study that they did, and the results they came up with, you know, people might have different opinions about that, but, you know, if no one was in a big hurry to get this done. So I wanted to follow the women, you know, through training, but there was going to be this 3-year wait period. And then when Ellen she started her research. I'm like, okay, you know, make sure you film yourself at, you know, why you're doing this, and do these things along the way. And once she had this fabulous archive and we pieced it all together, and you meet these women who were, so she mentioned Charlie Folletta, who was the Harvard grad. Charlie is all of 5 feet tall, 5'0". And she went in, and Lori, when she was talking earlier, was saying it all comes down to culture change, right? And, you know, I will say the women entered, and if Ellen presented her research formally, she sort of categorized it by year, right? They come in and they're enthusiastic and they're optimistic. And then, and you'll see in our little clip, which we'll show in just a minute, for combat arms officers, the normal thing to do once you go through infantry officer basic leader course or the armor version of that, but particularly for the infantry, is you go to ranger school. And in 2015, before infantry and armor actually opened to women, but experimentally they opened ranger school. And it was a big news story, and 3 women graduated. Chris Grist, Shea Haver, and Lisa Jaster. Those 3 women graduate. And then when these women that Ellen was following finish I Bullock and A Bullock and they head off to Ranger School, none of the women, and Ellen, I don't know how many were, I know 36 showed up to be interviewed. I don't know how many were in the entire cohort that were going through, but when they opened Ranger School to women in 2015, and 3 women actually made it through, then they left Ranger School open, right? Before, the only criteria for going to Ranger School was you had to be a man. You could be in any MOS, you could be a chaplain, you could be a medic, you could be an admin. It didn't matter, but you had to be a man to go to Ranger School. And now all these women are coming through, the first 3 graduate, and then no women graduate. And another woman, so the film is about 3 of the women that Ellen interviewed. And then that their stories, right? So she followed them for 5 years, and now we're going to raise money and get grants and go out and film them again now. But the story is framed by these 2, I call Ellen, you know, she was their public advocate, right? She was the one who was out there suing the SecDef. And there's another woman, Chris Fuhrer, who was hired by the Army to help oversee gender integration when it happened. And Chris Fuhrer kind of became a guardian angel and a confidant and a mentor to these women who were going through Ranger School, and she's still doing it. And it's these 2 amazing women from my generation, right? I'm Navy, they're Army, it doesn't matter. They not only did what Rosemary Mariner, the senior female naval aviator, you know, who was there when I was flying, said, you got to stay in and hold the door open. These women, you know, are of their own effort and through great, I don't know, personal expense and heartfelt passion have helped hold the door open and smooth the way, at least to try to get a more level playing field for these young women who started coming through in 2016. And all of their stories are remarkable. And I would just say, you know, what we're going to show you is just a 5-minute clip. And all it is it sort of goes into that, you know, a little bit about the early optimism and then into kind of the Ranger School phase. And you'll meet three of these women, and you will, you know, if you saw more of their video, you would truly fall in love with them. And I got to say, I know that I feel like I know them so well. I interface with them. I've never met any of them in person, but I love them because they are just amazing humans. And this clip is really nothing but it's no video. We've collected all the DoD footage, all the video of these women in their actual units. So we have that now. These are mostly stills that are either from the DoD or from their personal collections. And the film that Ellen and her sister and her colleagues shot. So none of it is the professional filmmaking part of it that we intend to do to wrap this story in. So it's, but it will introduce you to people that I think you will find inspiring and amazing.
I love the way you frame that, because like, that's the real story. What's going on the ground level as these women are going through the Ranger School, and like what's happening to like, and how is that working? Because that's where sort of like the rubber meets the road, so to speak. And if you don't have equity there, then nothing else matters, because they aren't able to progress. And one thing I want to point out, I know sometimes people were, you know, that I've talked to, just lay people, maybe people in this audience know it more, but who aren't always clear, is that the requirements have not changed. The requirements are the same. And they're saying is people who meet the requirements that have always been what they were, you know, whatever the gender, if you meet the requirements, you can get in, so to speak. That's the ideal. And the fight to fight isn't just, I mean, why does that matter? Why does that matter for women? Because it's not just about fighting. It's also about, you know, the brass ceiling and women having a seat at the table when larger decisions are being made and advice. And so I just think that's an important sort of macro view to hold this in, because sometimes, you know, people just say, why?
Yeah, and I'll reiterate something. So Rosemary Mariner, when she was fighting to get the combat cockpits open to women, you know, had sort of said when she was testifying and working with the Hill, you know, she said, look, when you treat one portion as different, right? They're not, you know, and this is in the wake of Tailhook. They're not going to, if you determine that they're different and they're a subclass, a lesser class, a somehow not fully qualified class, then people will treat each other that way, right? So she's talking about the way the male aviators, and those guys were my peers. Like, that was my time frame. Those were my peers, my friends. They were at Tailhook. And that was the attitude. It was very belittling toward women. And General Dempsey, when they revoked the combat exclusion policy, echoed Rosemary Mariner almost word for word when he said, look, if you define one class as warrior and one class as something other than warrior, you are not going to get equality. Okay, so that helped, you know, that was part of the justification of removing the combat exclusion policy. But that warrior mentality and what Lori said, where she said it's all about culture change. So right. Just, and what you learn when you listen to the 5 years of interviews and this leaders first policy that Ellen mentioned, is that the responsibility for culture change in the United States Army for gender integration fell on the shoulders of a bunch of 22-year-old women, right? There was not, it wasn't like don't ask, don't tell. It wasn't a top-down push. They tried to pretend it was all, like they didn't talk about it. It was just, we're doing this. And it, and so these women like shouldered, you know, this reluctant institution to try to push it toward change. And yet, you know, here they are, they're 22 years old and they're absorbing that experience and that resistance that came from, you know, a lot of different avenues.
Well, that's so well put, Joy, because like that to me, that's just like the drama of that's going to be the drama of the film. That's going to be that's
fingers
really
crossed
good.
Anybody wants to fund the film, get in touch with Daria.
Well,
she'll connect
well, I know,
with us.
And I know we want to show a clip, but I know that we're going to show the clip after we towards the end. So, Sean, maybe we should open up for a few questions first.
There's one here in the chat, Carol Wagner. How will the new PACT Act affect female veterans and their survivors?
I can venture an answer, but I think that's better. Lori should probably have answered that question. I think that the new PACT Act is very narrow in scope, which really disturbs me because, and you asked a question, Daria, about data. Well, the military does have the data, at least the Army does, because I FOIA'd the data on women who had engaged in combat. And I FOIA'd it way back in 2012 when I was trying, we were developing this lawsuit. And when I FOIA'd it, what I got back from them was that at that point in time, over 9,000 women had received combat action badges or higher level combat awards. The Army, at least, has kept the data. They know how many women and they know them by name. So the purpose of the PACT Act is to ensure that women are equally recognized and get equal recognition and benefits as a result of their combat actions. Many women have been denied. So for instance, one of the women that I interviewed for my dissertation, she was a combat or a cultural support team member. She'd served on Ranger direct action team. She had deployed in direct action situations over 15 times. And when she was going through the post-deployment, when you're reintegrating, and she wrote this down on this, you have to fill out all these papers when you're returning from redeployment. And she had written down that there was some psychological evaluations and she had written down how many actions she had been involved in. And she was, and it got reviewed by the medical health professionals there at the redeployment center. And they said, no way, no way you were involved in that many direct action situations. She said, I supported three Ranger teams, three different Ranger groups over a 9-month deployment because the Rangers come in and out much more quickly than she was, than the cultural support teams. They were usually there for 9 months to a year, where these direct action teams were only on the ground sometimes 3 to 6 months at a time. And they encouraged her to change her answers on that redeployment so that she could get out of there without being sent to mental health first. Unlike the guys who would come back with their units and go back to their home station with their units, they would not be held because they were assumed to get mental health support at their returning unit because they came back with a unit and they returned home with a unit. The women, unfortunately, very differently, were attached and assigned to these units on an as-need basis. So she did not get either. And the women also talk about how they didn't get awards, how when they got awards, they were handed out to them in parking lots rather than a big award ceremonies like what happened with the guys. And then people then just denied that they had seen the level of combat that they had seen. So the purpose of this act, and it's the JAX Act, not the PACT Act. I think you said PACT, not JAX.
That's right. The question was about the PACT Act, yes. But the JAX Act is, as that's all right. The JAX Act, as we were talking about earlier, this one is more about the recognition for the women. PACT Act is dealing more with like burn
exposure.
Pit, victims, exposures.
Yes.
We should, yeah.
I don't think it's going to, the PACT Act, sorry, I totally missed your question in that regard. It shouldn't have any difference effect for women, except unless their experiences, locations, their exposures have ever been denied, which I know in many cases they have.
What do you think is the biggest roadblock at this point to like Jack's Act Plus, as Lori was talking about at the beginning of the program?
Well, they're claiming that it's money. Congress is claiming that, oh, my, then we'd have to provide all this additional support to all these additional women in terms of, I don't really know what the money is linked to, but it has to do with VA healthcare. I guess women would be eligible for more extensive VA healthcare if they can, if their combat experience is recognized and documented appropriately. And
well,
now, right now, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I was only just gonna quote my, from my correspondence with Lori, it was that it's ironic because actually the numbers, if you really calculated, like the numbers, everyone I've talked to, the numbers of lionesses, the numbers of women who actually served as female engagement team members, cultural support team members, they're not that high. There's not good, it's not going to crack into anybody's budget. And so, but there, the resistance is, oh, well, you know, what if all these women come and say, I was a lioness or I was a cult, you know, this and that, and there's no documentation, but they say it, you know, how are we supposed to know? And what if, you know, the number balloons and we don't, you know, how much money are we going to have to pay? So that's the catch 22.
So I don't think it should be based on whether you were a female engagement team member or not. I think it should be based on your combat experience. And your combat experience is almost always documented through combat action badges or higher level awards that you received in combat zone. And you only get a combat action badge for very specific actions in a combat zone. And over in 2010, over, I'm sorry, 2012, over 9,000 women had already been recognized for their engaging in combat, in direct combat with the enemy. It's just frustrating. This whole act is frustrating to me because my colleague at SWAN, who was a combat reporter, has a Army Commendation Medal with a Valor device and a combat action badge. She wouldn't fit into any of this, the JAX inclusion, despite her two deployments to Iraq, where she supported infantry guys on the ground, and they recognized her. Her commanders in the field in Iraq recognized her with a combat action badge and then an Army Commendation Medal with a V device. You don't just give those things out to any old soldier.
That's, yeah. I mean, so it kind of, they're kind of looking for the wrong information. I don't know.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ellen, so, take for example, Dallas, who, one of the women in this clip, she was a combat medic in Afghanistan in 2007, 2008. She was always outside the wire, and she was there as a medic attached to infantry units, attached to special forces. And she was, I think, too embarrassed to put herself in for a combat action badge. She, I don't know what the different recognitions are, but she wasn't fully recognized, but she was in the same unit, in the same job, working with Monica Lynn Brown, who got, you know, the Silver Star.
Silver Star.
So right. They were just, they happened to be the medics. They were women. They got sent out. And there's no real record, I don't think, of who went out with whom, when, and where.
Yeah. I mean, most people, you don't put yourself in for a combat action badge. Your commanders put you in for that. Okay. And they usually put anybody in the unit that's engaged in direct action, whether that includes women or not. And so many women were recognized in that regard. And I think that's your data point. But then if that, is that going to make Congress, you know, go, oh no, we can't recognize these women. What? You mean they have been, their experience has been documented by these awards that their commanders gave them. You know, so we can recognize men with combat action badges, but not women.
Yeah.
Because it'll cost too much.
Yeah. I mean, but it's already happened. So you can't, it's not like you can't change it. It already happened. So I want to, now that we've, first of all, I want to just like thank Ellen and Joy so much for coming on. And I, to the extent that they will allow me, I would like to make sure there are updates on their film progress and any fundraisers or interests or anything like that that's going on that, you know, I can help with and get the word out. You know, we'll totally, I'm totally supportive of what you're doing. And I think it's just going to be really exciting. And so now that we're almost at the end of our time, we're gonna, Sean, are we ready? We can, unless you guys want to add anything, Joy?
I want to say two things. One is, Ellen and Chris have mentioned several times that essentially what Ellen did is, imagine, so the Tuskegee Airmen now, 50 years later at the end of their lives, are totally recognized for all the work they did, the integration and all of that effort. And so doing this film would be an effort to recognize what women are doing while during their lifetime as opposed to at the end of their lifetime. And the other thing is, when we started this, we were calling this Forward March and focusing more just on into the and the film is focused on the integration of infantry and armor in the army, but we want to couch that in some of the history that Lori reached back to, and so we've changed the title. So what you'll see is called Forward March, and what we're actually going to call the film, at least the working title now, is The Fight to Fight. So there'll be a little discrepancy there.
That'd be great. And then now that reminds me, I just want to say the last thing I want to say is I have to formally really thank Ellen, because without Ellen's connections and Ellen's generosity in working with me, I wouldn't have really, I mean, it really helped me network so I could get the contact the women that we had on the Lioness podcast, and you really helped make it possible. So, like, on behalf of the Veterans Breakfast Club, we just thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Daria, for doing all that you're doing.
Well, so now, if we're all set, we'll say goodbye. But everyone, just stay on, and you can see this. I've seen this clip. Unless Todd, you want to say
Yeah,
something?
no, I just want to explain that we're going to say goodbye to the viewers on YouTube and Facebook. We'll be shutting down that stream for copyright purposes. And those here in the Zoom room, please do stay on to watch this clip from the film.
Because it's amazing.
Because it's amazing.
We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt. Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco Free Adagio Health. Tobacco Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org, or you can check out the two Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was two wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco Free Adagio Health, for your support.